Anyway, let me now turn into Ernest Gellner. So I'm speaking. Having attended my young colleague Alan McFarlane's lectures over the term, what's he shown us? Well, firstly, a long survey from medieval up to the present of various isms, Enlightenment, evolutionism, functionalism. And I think he's shown that the paradigm shifts in the social sciences can be partly accounted for by major shifts in power and technology. The dominance of the West at certain periods led to very evolutionary theories, and then when there was a balance, this changed. So that social theories are ideologies. They're no more privileged than any set of theories, and therefore anthropologists, sociologists, economists, and so on are just the priests of our modern society. I think he's also shown us that those who we take most seriously are the people whose lives are full of contradiction. Their heart is in one world, their mind is in another, as in Tocqueville and all the more or less all the thinkers he's looked at. He's also, I'm pleased to say, noticed that many of the great thinkers were Jewish, as I am myself, particularly, obviously, Durkheim and Marx. And I would like to think that I am in this great tradition that he's been describing. I'm poised between social systems, and I try and analyze in my work and life how these opposing, contradictory, warring systems work. And I'm particularly interested in the question, which almost everyone else has forgotten, which is how peculiar our world is and how it emerged. This was the central theme of his lectures. But if you look around you at most of the theorists who you read now, you'll find that they've forgotten the question. As Tocqueville famously said, after a revolution, it's impossible really to reconstruct what the question was. So nearly all contemporary thinkers are just lost in minor questions. And I think the great question of sociology, which is the emergence of modern industrial capitalist liberal societies, is more or less forgotten by everyone. But it has been my life's obsession, and this is because of my life. I was born in 1925, the son of a Jewish journalist turned businessman from Czechoslovakia. Incidentally, if you don't get all these details, don't worry. Alan has very kindly put them on his website. I came from Germany as a migrant to London, and I went to a school in Kentish Town, and then to St. Albans Grammar School, the same school that Jack Goody later, about that time, went to. And I went then to Oxford, Balliol College, and in 1949 I got a first in philosophy, politics and economics. I wrote several books in that early period, some of which became notorious. One of them, Words and Things, was an attack on Oxford linguistic philosophy, in which, in the last famous chapter, which amused me a lot, I basically said that Oxford linguistic philosophy was invented because you weren't allowed to talk about anything important in Oxford: women, sex, religion, politics, anything at high table. So all you could talk about was words, and that's why it took that sterile turn. Well, this didn't endear me to Oxford linguistic philosophers, as you can imagine. And Bertrand Russell and various others slugged it out. So Words and Things, if you're interested in my attacking mode, read the last chapter, The Anthropology of Philosophy, in that book. I then got an anthropology PhD at the LSE and turned that into the book called Saints of the Atlas. And later worked in Morocco and wrote a book called Muslim Society on that subject. I think the tensions in my life are between my Jewish Czech background, which is all Gemeinschaft and warmth and all that sort of stuff, and coming to England, grammar school, Oxford, the cold, sterile world of advanced industrial capitalism. The movement from community to association, from status to contract, all those great things I've lived out in my own life. And I've always felt on the margin of things. But I want to belong, so I want to belong, I want to get back to that warm, cozy world. But all the ideologies and faiths which suggest how you can do that appall me because they demand too much of me. One of them is Marxism, and much of my life has been an attack on Marxism. I admire many Marxists and I admire Marx, but the effects he had on my own country of Czechoslovakia and Eastern Europe is so appalling that I've spent much of my adult life studying communism, and I think I know more about it than many people. I spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe. I speak most of the East European languages, including Russian, and I was in Russia in 1989 when the Soviet Union collapsed. So much of my life has been spent observing, as an anthropologist, Soviet life. The other system that demands everything of you is Islam. And so the other half of my life really has been looking at Islamic civilizations and trying to understand the faith, warmth of that world, which I also reject. I tried also psychoanalysis, or at least I didn't try doing it, but I wrote an attack on psychoanalysis, the psychoanalytic movement, which is an anthropology of psychoanalysis. I also have attacked almost everything. I wrote a book about postmodernism and postmodernity, which I think is a sham and a fraud, and I may come on to that later. My inspiration really is from the world of reason. My greatest hero is David Hume, and in this room I've often lectured about David Hume, the great Enlightenment thinker who is full of doubt and questioning and rationality. And I've tried to apply my philosophical background to the understanding of what's happening in the world. Like Montesquieu, Smith, Tocqueville, my central obsession is with liberty. This is why almost my last book, and I think one of my better books, is called The Conditions of Liberty. Because I, above all, fear totalitarian thought systems and social systems. When I drove to Prague in 1945, I carried in my pocket Koestler's the best expose of communism ever written, Koestler's Darkness at Noon, and also George Orwell's Animal Farm. Those are the two books I had in my pocket when I went at the end of the war. As I've written in relation to such systems, as to the closed systems, I suppose I have a horrified fascination with them, having been throughout my life deprived of convictions and faith. People who have faith irritate me, fascinate me, and I would like to work out how they tick. So basically, I'm trying to live out the Enlightenment ideal, but trying to apply it to modern situations. And why I'm particularly interested in Islam is that it seems to be the last, after the fall of the Soviet Union, it seems to be the only world view or world ideology which is still trying to maintain a closed system. I agree with Tocqueville that Islam is the religion which has most completely confounded and intermixed the two powers, so that all the acts of civil and political life are regulated more or less by religious law. Islam, for me, as I've put elsewhere, exemplifies a social order which seems to lack much capacity to provide political countervailing institutions or associations, which is atomized without much individualism and operates effectively without intellectual pluralism. I put this in Conditions of Liberty, page 29. The other system that does the same thing is the Soviet Union. It tries to embed everything, using Polanyi's phrase. Society, religion, politics, economics is all joined up together. As I put it, under the communist system, truth, power and society are intimately fused. I agree with Kolakowski, that's Kolakowski. The underlying moral aspiration of Marxism is the abolition of the separation between the social and the political. And I found it particularly exciting after 1989 to see what happens when the Soviet Union collapsed and the world began to be separated in the normal capitalist individualistic way. So what is this world that we live in, the tragic nature of modernity? Because obviously this kind of world is conquering everything. It's now conquering the third of the world, or the quarter of the world that is China. It's already done that to India. It's done it to Eastern Europe. The only bit that's holding out, so to speak, is the Islamic world. As I put it, without any shadow of doubt, industrial capitalist society is conquering, absorbing all the other cultures of the earth. It's the single largest transformation in world history since the discovery of farming. But it has terrible consequences. As I put it in one of my metaphors, and I love metaphors, the modern industrial machine is like an elephant in a very small boat. It presupposes an enormous infrastructure, not merely of political order, but educationally, culturally, in terms of communication, and so on. So what is the essence of this world? Well, one central theme is the growth of rationality, or as Weber put it, the disenchantment of the world. I greatly admire Weber. I think he is the greatest of sociologists. There's a transition from a world where thought was embedded in religion, economics and society, to rationality, disenchantment, where you can look at problems and deal with them directly, what we sometimes call the Cartesian disassociation after Descartes. This is what I call the transition to effective knowledge, or what scientists now call the move to reliable knowledge. It's a world which my teacher Karl Popper at the LSE talked about in his books on work on the open society. It's what Thomas Kuhn talks about in The Paradigm Shift. It's the movement towards what I've described as the attainment of a rational, non-magical, non-enchanted world, which I think is a far greater shift than any particular Kuhnian paradigm shift. It's not just one shift to from one paradigm to another. It's in a sense the end of paradigms, and it's the movement to a new kind of rational order. But the cost of this is terrible. And taking my ideas from Kant and Weber, the cost of this disenchantment is basically loss of meaning. The modern world, as I put it, provides no warm, cozy habitat for man. The impersonality and regularity which makes it knowable are also at the same time the very features which makes it almost unlivable in. This is from the Legitimation book, page 184. Our world, as I put it, is notoriously a cold, morally indifferent world. It's notable, as I put it, for its icy indifference to values, its failure to console and reassure, its total inability to validate norms and values, or to offer any guarantee of their eventual success. The open predicament, the world of open society, as Robin Horton, my friend, the anthropologist, and others have put it, is one of great insecurity and anxiety, because there are no firm fundamental guidelines. Logical consistency and openness is brought at the price of social and moral inconsistency. The world of Islam and communism at least offers a unified vision, one vision. Science and openness offers not another, but no vision. This is from my book on the Sacred Grove, page 239. But we can't go back. We would love to go back to Eden and a world of in which things are joined together, but we can't. We can't return to that world. So we have to make the best we can of the world we live in. This world is defined, as I put it, above all by the existence of a unique, unstable and powerful system of knowledge of nature. So basically we have a choice. We can either live with cozy warmth and social meaning and religious meaning, or we can live in an open, free, tolerant but cold world. And this in a way is a continuation of Weber's ideas of the iron cage, that rationality imprisons us in a different kind of way. The other essential feature of the modern world is the separation of spheres. I go on about this quite a lot, but I think it is very important. Basically most civilizations, as you know, as anthropologists, merge things in hunter-gatherer societies, in tribal societies, even in peasant societies on the whole, religion, politics, kinship and economics emerged. And that is the why anthropology is such a holistic discipline, because in order to understand one, you have to understand them all, and you can't break them apart. There's no separation of institutions, there's no distinction. But in the modern world, we pretend or try and keep them as much apart as possible. We try and split the atom and keep these different areas from fusing, so that none of the institutions becomes dominant. There's no determining infrastructure. Marx believed in the last instance in the determination of the economic infrastructure, and Hegel in the determination of ideas, but there is no determination in modern societies. Everything fights with everything else, and everything has its own realm. So your obligations to your kin come into conflict with your obligations to your religious faith, to your economic activity, to your political allegiances, and none of them trumps the other, so to speak. This is the key feature of modern open societies. The main feature seems to be less in the absence of ideological elements, there are plenty of ideological elements around, and in the particular balance of power which exists between them in our society. In the majority of agrarian societies, as in communism, nothing is separated. As I put it, political, economic, ritual and any other kinds of obligation are superimposed on each other in a single idiom. And in such a situation, you can't have civil society. Civil society is a term which wasn't familiar to British academics until the 1980s. They had civil society, they didn't know they had it, until East Europeans told them they had civil society and that they wanted it as well. So there's my work and a lot of my pupils' work has been on developing, like Chris Hand's, been developing the ideas of civil society. In communism you can't have civil society. In Islam you can't have civil society. Of course you have bits and pieces. But basically civil society meaning that realm which lies between the top and the bottom, between the state, whatever, and its ideology, and the individual citizen. That, in a system which is where you've got no separation of powers and no separation of spheres, any kind of middling authority or group, a university, a college, a firm, anything that starts to take on too much life and power is a threat to the dominant ideology. And therefore, if you look at the history of later Islamic societies, particularly Ottoman society, for instance, you find the expunging, the destroying of any city governments, any separate universities, etc. You find the same thing, of course, in other hegemonic civilizations. I don't know much about, and I haven't written much about China, but I gather that this is, if you look at much of Chinese history over the last 1,000 years, you find the same phenomena, and to a certain extent in Japan, and you certainly find it in Soviet Union. There's no talk of civil society really, or what we mean by it in such situations, because civil society is based on the separation of the polity from the economy and social life, and this is quite an unusual and recent development. In fact, civil society refers to a situation where social life, individual life, is not dominated by the political institutions. The moment the state gets its hand on civil society, then it's the end of civil society. And this is why, of course, Durkheim's ideas are completely trivial. And this, by the way, has nothing to do with Gellner. That was me. I better confine myself to Ernest. Now, of course, many people who know about the history of political philosophy and thought will know that many of my ideas are derived from others. There's nothing much very new here, in a way. It comes from the Scottish Enlightenment, to a certain extent from Durkheim, Weber and Marx, from the philosophy of Ibn Khaldun, that's I-B-N-K-H-A-L-D-U-N, the great Islamic philosopher of the 13th century. And if you put them all together, you get much of the message that I've got and has come out of these series of lectures. What I think is unusual about my work, as I said at the beginning, is that I'm one of the few people who still ask these questions and still approach these subjects in this way. It would be very unfashionable for a postmodernist to take such broad sweeping views and it would all be deconstructed. But I still feel the sense of shock and newness that the people who lived through this revolution felt, Montesquieu, Hume, Smith, Ferguson, and up to Weber. Because I saw the other world. I was brought up in Czechoslovakia. I have many friends in Eastern Europe, and it's not to be taken for granted. And I've also seen and felt the costs of the disenchantment. The costs of this world have been recognized by many of the great thinkers. It's put in different terms. Marx talks in terms of alienation, Durkheim in terms of anomie, and Weber in terms of disenchantment. They're all talking about the same problem. Now, the next question I want to move on to is, how did this strange thing happen? Because it goes right against the grain. The normal course of laws of human development wouldn't lead you to the outcome that we have of an open, liberal industrial world. Nearly always, through the long periods of history, there have been two tendencies, which I describe a lot in my books. One is the tendency towards increasing political predation. This you've heard about a lot in terms of Montesquieu and Tocqueville and others. Basically, as they put it, as societies get wealthier, it's rather like Malthus's law. Wealth increases fertility, which then negatively feeds back into rising population. The political version of that law is that as societies get wealthier and make more money, then it goes to the powerful. And so they become more powerful, and the law of political predation and centralization and bureaucracy builds up. So in the end, they hit a trap, which means that they can't proceed any further because they become too powerful at the center. It works through all sorts of ways which these great thinkers have noted, like war and so on, but it's nearly universal law. So the tendency is towards what many have described as absolutism or despotism. It arises from all sorts of things. I was particularly interested, having studied in North Africa, the problem that if you accumulate wealth, you have to guard wealth, and in order to guard wealth, you have to build up your military and political power. So the problem of many of the North African states and so on was that you basically had to put more and more into military technologies and political centralization. It's the problem that's facing America now. It's just spending more and more of its money on armaments and trying to defend itself. And it's also turning, as many of you know, into a more and more aggressive and illiberal society, at least some people say such a thing. I wouldn't dare in a lecture to reveal my political views. roughly, the general sociological law of agrarian society states that man must be subject to either kings or cousins, though quite often, of course, he is subject to both, as I put in my book on Liberty, page 8. But there has been an exception, some exceptions, otherwise I wouldn't be here talking to you in Cambridge. There has been, sometimes falteringly and sometimes nearly extinguished, the growth of equality, plurality and openness against the normal rules. So the normal rules are tendencies, not laws, and it is possible to become richer, more open. The first notable sign of this, as far as I can see, was in Northwest Europe around the 17th century, 18th century. The Dutch, the English, some Scandinavians moved in a unusual direction. Of course, there'd been many examples of this before. Ancient Greece, Athens, the Renaissance city-states, at times Japan, at times China, at times India. Almost every society has periods when it has this movement towards a freer and more open civilization, but nearly always in the past had been snuffed. This is the one case where mysteriously, instead of being crushed, as say the Italian city-states were, by the French and others, it proceeded and continued. And this is one of the interesting historical questions. How did, for the first time, something emerge which you couldn't have predicted? Not only was there sustained economic growth, but the natural tendency towards absolutism and greater stratification, because the other law, which I should have mentioned, but is on the handout, is the movement towards increasing social predation. Basically, along with the political predation, a word that I like, predation, there's the idea that as wealth increases, you get more and more inequality. You get the growth of castes or classes or some stratification, because there's more wealth to distribute, but most of it goes to the top. So the top become richer and richer, and the poor become poorer and poorer, as again is happening in America and to a certain extent in England and many parts of the world. So how did we escape from that law to a world where, for a time anyway, there was a growth of wealth in the middling as well as the top and the bottom? And towards a world which, to my mind, is characterized by something extraordinary. I often reflect on the wording of the American Declaration of Independence: we hold these truths to be self-evident, that man is born free and equal. Well, as I've often pointed out, it's a ridiculous remark. It's completely non-self-evident that men are born free and equal. In fact, 99% of the people on this planet through history have believed the opposite. So how did a few people in America and the West take such a view, and now why is it so widely adhered to? Freedom and equality. So let's have a look at how this happened. But I gather Alan stops after 40 minutes, so I'm going to follow his practice and give you a couple of minutes break before I proceed. Okay? If you want to ask me a question to Ernest Gellner and how it is that 7 years after I died, I'm still with you, you can do. But if you beseech me on your knees to revert to Alan McFarlane, I also will do that. Refreshed, relaxed, in-flight exercise is done. We'll proceed. So how did this happen? Well, my theories are... There's a section on my theories in my book on sword, plough and book called The Conditions of the Exit, if you particularly want to go, and I list what I think are the main factors there. But basically, here are some of the theories. Firstly, what has happened is that religion and politics in the West have been split apart. I think it's not just Protestantism, as Weber... Weber didn't argue, and I don't argue that it's Protestantism. Basically, something odd happened in that the alliance which you find in Catholicism between the church and the state, and you find in most world religions, like Islam and, to a certain extent, many periods of Buddhism, somehow they fell out with each other. You can see it in Scotland, for instance, in the early 18th century, when for a long time the Calvinists' pastors were dominated the political scene as well. But gradually they were shoved aside and told, you know, you keep your preaching to religion and morals and we'll look after the state. And this happened in England as well, to a certain extent Holland. It's a very unusual thing to get a separation. This clearly happened. And we can see it happening in Protestant societies in northwestern Europe from about the 16th, 17th centuries. And in America, it flowered, as Tocqueville described. This leads to, it's related to another insight of Weber, which I find useful, that somehow Protestantism takes that strand in Christianity which is anti-magic, anti- the infusing of another world in this material world, which is what most religions believe, that everything is enchanted and filled with some spirit. And Protestantism set its face against this. It said, this world is this world. God is up there. He doesn't do miracles. The wine doesn't have blood in it. It's not turned into blood. Separate things out. It all is part of the separations, Descartes, the body, the mind, and religion and politics. So the alliance of priests and rulers is broken, and the clerics and the rulers go into confrontation. I write quite a lot about this, and you can pursue that if you want to. neither of them is powerful enough to destroy the other. It's a variant of the idea that Adam Smith had about the kings and the burghers and the nobility fighting with each other. None of them could quite dominate the other. So you get a separation of religion and politics. A second separation or development, which I think is very important, is the victory of production over predation. Almost always in civilizations in history, the military have run the system. They have the technology to control everyone else, because they can kill them if it comes to that. So in the end, the wealth producers, the factory owners, the artisans, the shopkeepers, etc., are subdued under the power of the military aristocracy or whatever. What happened in a peculiar way in the West was that production, making money, making wealth, the famous nation of shopkeepers that, as Napoleon described the British, the nation of shopkeepers won out, that somehow producing wealth became a more viable, more powerful way of attaining power than killing people. There was a period of economic and cognitive growth. You'd find it before in Greece or in the Italian city-states, but in each case it had been snuffed out. Normally you get oases of wealth, as Ibn Khaldun pointed out in the 13th, 14th century. The recurrent pattern is the growth of wealth in small city-states or cities, and then the wolves on the periphery come in and destroy the wealth. But for the first time, a civilization in Northwest Europe emerged where the wolves were held at bay, the wealth increased, and production dominated. And this temporary reversal became more or less permanent. There was a permanently growing economy. The subduing of political by economic power was the great triumph. And this is where I think one of the places where Marx got it wrong. As I put it, Marxism made it a taunt that the bourgeois state was merely a kind of executive committee of the bourgeoisie. That this should ever have become possible is perhaps mankind's greatest social achievement ever. That's in Conditions of Liberty, page 206. That we are a nation run by shopkeepers. Margaret Thatcher was the last exact shopkeeper or daughter of a shopkeeper, but Blair is another shopkeeper, really. And the rest of them, Brown is certainly a shopkeeper. That's a pretty unusual thing for a nation to be run by shopkeepers. Of course, America is too, in another form. How did this happen? Well, it's so difficult that my only guess is my trump card is what I, in my usual, I like to reverse things. You've probably heard of Deus ex machina, which means the god coming down on a machine in Greek tragedies to resolve some problem. Well, I've reversed this round and called it machina ex Deus, the machine from God, in other words, technology and science, coming down to resolve my intellectual problem, which is how this modern world emerged. Because I think that the key to, I'm not interested in particularly in science and technology, but I think the key to what has happened is the growth of science and technology. That is the moving spirit for me that has suddenly led production and wealth to overtake predation and to lead to an open world. As my friend Perry Anderson summarizes my argument, in substance, my argument has consistently been that science and science alone brings modern industry that yields mass prosperity, which permits effective morality. It is the material affluence afforded by scientific reason that is its epistemological trump card. So, something's happened. The fortunate miracle that has changed everything is the Industrial Revolution. Before that, wealth was earned through agrarian activities, through farming and so on, and that always led to hierarchical social order and centralized political systems. Industrial civilization, which emerged in the West in the 18th, 19th centuries, first in England, alongside the scientific revolution, the two are interconnected, but that Industrial Revolution gave a new foundation to the making of wealth. The The change was, as to a certain extent Adam Smith realized, that before there was a finite limit. You can produce wealth up to a certain limit, then you hit all sorts of laws in agrarian societies. Industrial civilization, when coupled with science, is endless. You can just go on and on and on. I mean, there will be, as we're noticing, some outer limits of climate change and so on, but the potential for recurring growth is much higher as a result of science and technology. It's a perpetual revolution rather than a finite one. And I think this has changed all the equations. What it's basically done is to make the virtuous, and I put in virtuous in inverted commas, i.e. people with humdrum bourgeois values, rational, sane, getting on with the work, truthful, trustful, all the sorts of things that civility, which Adam Smith and others pointed out might be the result of capitalist activity, those have triumphed, those virtues have triumphed over the heroic military honour virtues that I've seen in among the Bedouin and so on. How has this happened? Well, it's happened because of this scientific and technological revolution in England, and the curious alchemy whereby private affluence and hard work leads to the public power, so that a country which makes a lot of money, as in 18th century England, and which has a good banking system and so on, gradually became the most powerful nation on earth. Not because it had a huge army or a very well-trained military aristocracy, but because it was generating wealth through its factories and production. This was turning into money, which it could borrow to fight people or put into recruiting people from all over the world to fight for it, including Scotland. And in this situation, this little place became, this hard-working little island became the biggest empire on earth. But it managed to maintain its, to a large extent, its political openness and its liberal values within that system. So in the end, all the states of the world had to pay attention to this, because this was a new model. How and why did this develop? Well, you can look at it at an island level of England or Holland or Northwest Europe, but you really need to look at it, as the great thinkers said, at a European level. The peculiarity of Europe, which made this possible, is the one which the Enlightenment thinkers drew attention to, which is that Europe is an odd geographical configuration. Basically, it's broken up by rivers, seas, lots of indentations. So over history and since the fall of the Roman Empire, there's been no empire that has dominated Europe. There have been constant battles between these small nation-states, or usually states to begin with, and later nation-states, so that Italy has been against France and Spain against Portugal and England against everyone, etc. And in such a situation, you don't get a homogenization and a political centralization, which tends to build up the moment you get a large, very large imperial system. The downfall of China was, in terms of material development, occurred when it became unified for a very long period, and the same in other large imperial systems. Europe was like China in its period of warring states. It was technologically very innovative, because any invention in one part was then taken up in other parts, and it was impossible to crush liberty entirely or technology entirely. So the political system was conducive to a new kind of order. The last thing about technology, which is one of my ideas, is that there's a game called Grandmother's Footsteps. Do any of you know Grandmother's Footsteps? Some of you? It's a game where the grandmother stands like this and the children stand over there, and they have to creep up on grandmother, and grandmother occasionally turns round, and if she sees any of them coming up, then she sends them back. Well, my theory of technology is really, though I never put it in my work, and it's Alan who's pointed it out to me, is the theory of grandmother's footsteps. The state was busy doing things. Meanwhile, the wealth producers, the businessmen, the middle classes, and the scientists were busily making money, and they crept up on me. And when I turned round to stop them, it was too late. They were here, they captured me. So I have a heavy emphasis on the slow, gradual, invisible development of technologies. If it's too dramatic, then the state will stop it. The Japanese they decided they didn't want gunpowder weapons, as did the Chinese or the Islamic civilizations. Some new technology like that was just stopped. The Western, Northwestern states didn't stop the technology until it was too late and had overtaken them, just as I talked to some, or Alan talked to some of you about Henry VIII trying to stop the idea of trusts. It was too late when he tried to do it. So the summary of the arguments, basically, I'll leave out the summary because you can reconstruct that and time is short. So just to end on some criticisms and weaknesses, I love three-fold models. Sometimes I go for two or four or eight. But basically, I like models which are before, middle, end. And much of my work, like the title of my book, Sword, Plough, and Book, that's the three-fold model. So basically, there was hunter-gatherer societies, then there was agrarian societies, and then there's industria. I call them agraria industria. It's a good way to think. Most things come in threes. But it can become a straitjacket. And some of my friends, including Alan, have pointed out that I tend to lump all agrarian societies as roughly, generically similar. And he thinks that as a result of that, it's impossible for me really to explain how the modern world emerged, because there was something odd in some of these agrarian societies. They weren't the same, they're not structurally similar. So I think there's a danger of lumping and being too philosophical and cut and dried in one's models. A second weakness is that, at least Alan thinks there's a weakness, is that I think the great divide was the end of feudalism and the beginning of capitalism. That feudalism was the integrated world of politics and religion and so on, and then came capitalism and the modern world, which broke them. Alan tells me that Maitland and Maine and others saw feudalism already as being highly separated and contractual and before the divide. And this is in line with Marxist thought, which is that basically the modern world came directly from feudalism, not in opposition to it. So that might be another weakness in my arguments. And thirdly, because I haven't paid too much attention to scientific and technological growth, I tend to take it for granted that people will pursue technological and scientific growth, whereas many people argue that if you look at the histories of technologies and science in most civilizations, they don't. Who wants curiosity? Who wants people thinking freshly? Who wants to replace human labor by machines? Most people don't. So the growth of technology and science is a mystery in itself, and it isn't, you can't use it as a trump card to explain everything else without trying to explain it. Infinite regression. And the future? Well, like Weber, I'm half optimistic, half pessimistic. I've seen the world nearly lose all of this. I saw 1939 to 45. I know that from again and again, the world has almost lost all this liberty, openness, wealth, and so on. So I'm completely opposed, and I did argue with Fukuyama about the end of history. I think it's absolutely nonsense. History has not ended, and this may be looked back on as a strange liberal phase, for all I know. But I try and be balanced and hopeful, and I think that we do live in an extraordinarily wealthy, open, positive kind of world, even if there are individual costs psychologically and in the ways I talked about it. And so to conclude, as I did in one of my articles, on balance and with misgivings, we opt for our modern world. But there's no question of an elegant, clear-cut choice. We are half pressurized by necessity, fear of famine and so on, half persuaded by a promise of liberal affluence, which we do not fully trust. There it is. Lacking better reasons, we'll have to make do with these. So, it's hardly a ringing endorsement, but rather two cheers for liberty, wealth, and equality. But I think three cheers. So, Thank you very much.